Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
David Rubenstein is founder of the Carlyle Group, a global private equity company he founded in 1987 and still leads today. He's made billions of dollars, and he's giving a lot of it away as he identifies himself as a patriotic philanthropist. In 2013, he began leading a series of interviews of accomplished American historians about their books in front of an audience comprised mostly of members of Congress at the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C. Many of these conversations, called congressional dialogues, have been transcribed and printed in David's new book, The American Story. David, before we get to the book, what is patriotic philanthropy?
What I mean by that is this. I've bought historic documents like the Magna Carta or the Declaration of Independence and put them on display where people can see them, where I fixed the Washington Monument, Monticello, Montpelier, Mount Vernon, things like that. I'm trying to say that this type of philanthropy is designed to remind people of the history and heritage of our country, the good and the bad. So when I put up the money to help fix Monticello, Thomas Jefferson's home, I insisted that the slave quarters be built out so people know that Thomas Jefferson, for all of his strengths, was also a slave owner. And so I think Americans don't know as much about our history as they should, and I want to remind them more about it on the theory that if you know about the past, you can avoid the mistakes more readily in the future. So that's what history is all about, learning about the past, hopefully doing things better in the future. Right now, three-quarters of Americans in a recent survey could not name the three branches of our federal government. One-third of Americans could not, in the same survey, name one branch of our federal government. 10% of American college graduates in a recent survey said Judge Judy is a member of the United States Supreme Court. 16% of Americans in a recent survey said that Justice Scalia is the Chief Justice of the United States. Of course, he's passed away. So we don't really know much about history, and I'm really trying to do some things to remind people more about it.
And there's no foundation or LLC or anything like that. This is just you, right?
No, it's just my money, and I've been very fortunate in the business world. I was an original signer of the Giving Pledge, and that says you're going to give away half your net worth. I'm in the process of trying to give away all of my money. I've been very fortunate. It came from very modest circumstances. My parents were not high school educated, and I just got lucky in life, and now I'm giving my money away, and this is one of the things I'm giving my money away to.
The congressional dialogues, what did you hope to accomplish with members of Congress as your audience members for these?
I ask members of Congress, when we do these dinners, we had one this week, to sit with people from the opposite party and to sit with people from the opposite house. Because there isn't much legislation these days, we don't have conference committees, and so members of the House and members of the Senate don't usually interact as much as they used to, and obviously because of the partisan divide in Washington, Democrats and Republicans are not talking to each other that much. But in this dinner, that's kind of a truce that evenings of the dinners, and people do talk with each other. My goal is to educate members of Congress a little bit more about our history, because they're the people that are making the laws, and surely the people making the laws should know more about our history than the average citizen, though the average citizen should know something, of course. So I think the members of Congress look forward to it. We get several hundred members of Congress and their guests coming every evening. We do this. We do it once a month. So I think it's made some modest impact in improving the dialogue between Democrats and Republicans, but obviously the era of good feelings hasn't broken out in Washington yet.
Well, the conversations in this book consist of a veritable historian hall of fame, David McCullough with John Adams, Ron Chernow, Alexander Hamilton, Doris Kearns Goodwin, and Lincoln and FDR. For the people who've read those historians' works, what does the conversation format provide that reading their respective books doesn't?
If you read the respective books, you are in very good shape. I have read all of those books, but it takes a long time. Some of these books are 700 or 800 pages. And I have to admit that most Americans probably don't have the time or maybe in some cases the inclination to read books that long. So if you read the dialogues in my book, you will see the best of these individuals' views on these various presidents without having to read the longer books. Now, I say in my book, please read the longer book if you are inclined to learn more about it, but if you're not, you can read the interviews. And the interview format, just like the format we're engaging in right now, does tend to give a back and forth and back and forth, and it's relatively easy to follow.
Of the 16 conversations in the book, only two of the scholars are women. Why do presidential scholars seem to be predominantly male?
Well, it's called history, H-I-S, story, his story. And that's because men usually were historians, and men were usually writing about what they knew the best, men. So Doris Kearns Goodwin is obviously a terrific historian, and she's written about men. But some historians have written about women, and one of those is in the book, Cokie Roberts. It wrote three extraordinary books about what women did in the early days of our country, even during the Civil War. And what Cokie Roberts showed is through the letters that these women were writing, they had a lot of influence on their husbands. And the women in those days, if they were married, could not own property in their own name. They couldn't vote, and they couldn't be office holders. But they exercised power behind the scenes, and they were actually quite influential. But you are correct in saying that there aren't as many women who are historians as men. And I think we're trying to correct that. And in my other interviews I've done, I've had more and more women brought to this program. And the next volume that comes out, there'll be many more women authors.
Well, you mentioned Doris Kearns Goodwin. Her stories about her subjects have always fascinated me. FDR walking in on Winston Churchill when he was emerging naked from a bathtub in the White House. She talks about this sense of living with her biographical subjects for 5, 6, 10 years, or however long it takes her to write a book. Do you get the sense that a majority of the historians have that same experience?
Yeah, very few historians spend 5 to 10 years with a person and then say, you know, I hate this person. I wish I hadn't spent this much time. They do tend to see the better parts of these individuals, and they do tend to live with them, and in the end, they really admire them. Obviously, if you're writing a book about Hitler, that's a different situation. But the kind of books that I've talked about in this book that I've written, these are people that all admire the people that they have written about, and they all know the flaws of them. And as it is said, nobody is a hero to his valet. Everybody who gets close to somebody sees his or her faults. But on the whole, the people that studied Washington or Lincoln or FDR do see the benefits of this person's leadership rather than the flaws this person might have had.
One of the conversations in the book is with Bob Woodward about Richard Nixon. And Woodward's not a historian per se, but he covered Nixon as a journalist, never met him. But do you get the sense that he admires Nixon?
Well, that's a good point, and it shows that I exaggerated a bit. Bob Woodward did not admire Richard Nixon. But he did admire some of the people that he wrote about, but not Richard Nixon. And interestingly, Richard Nixon never met Bob Woodward. Bob Woodward tried, after Richard Nixon resigned, to meet with him, talk with him, but Nixon would never do so for perhaps obvious reasons. And had the tapes not come out, I think Richard Nixon would have survived. It was the tapes that did him in. You might say, why didn't he burn the tapes as soon as it was revealed? Well, he always thought the Supreme Court would let him keep the tapes. He thought they were private. In those days, the president's papers were owned by the president. We've changed the law, but when Richard Nixon was president, the president's papers and all the things in the White House relating to his being president were actually owned by him, and he thought that they would never be taken away, and obviously proved wrong. And as soon as the tapes became public, his fate was sealed.
When you talked to Bob Woodward, did you get the sense that he had a different perspective on the president he was covering because he covered him in real time versus historians who are looking through historical documents?
Well, when you look at historical documents, you don't have the same perspective as people who are doing things day to day. When you're on deadline, like Bob Woodward was, you have to, get information in the paper the next day, and therefore you do have shortcuts. You don't know as much as you're going to know when you see the historic documents years later. So being a journalist is much different. It doesn't give you as much time to really study these things. I think the hindsight, of course, Bob Woodward has become a prolific author, and I think has written more number one bestseller than any other nonfiction writer in our country's history. So he does become more of a writer of books as his career unfolded. And in this book, I talk a little bit about, and he talks a little about the book he wrote about Alexander Butterfield, who was the person who revealed publicly that Nixon had a taping system. Had that not been revealed, I suspect that Nixon would survive his second term.
What also comes out in the interviews, and we mentioned it with Nixon, is the humanity of the presidents, flaws and all, and every president seems to have a flaw that scars their legacy, like JFK with Bay of Pigs and Lyndon Johnson with Vietnam. Are there a lot of these flaws that students miss during their broad study of the presidents in high school and college?
Well, when I was in high school, we tended to tell people, students like me, what the great things were that George Washington did or Abraham Lincoln. And we didn't tend to focus on the flaws, but as people have written much better biographies of these individuals in recent years, we do see the flaws much more. When the early biographies were written about George Washington, everything made him into a god. He had no flaws. But now, as more historians have written books about him, they tend to show the good and the bad, and I think people recognize that all people have good and bad characteristics, and I think it's good to know the bad characteristics as well as the good characteristics of people so that we put them in proper perspective.
You're an interviewer of people, and I couldn't help but notice in the book, one of my favorite conversations was with Chief Justice John Roberts about the U.S. Supreme Court, And it seemed like Roberts, for somebody that's been in front of the Supreme Court so many times and knows how to keep talking, his answers were very short compared to the historians. Why do you think that is?
Well, in some cases, I tell the people in the beginning, it's hard to cover as much as I want to cover in 45 minutes to an hour. So, don't give too many long answers. In some cases, I might have edited down the answers. But he is not a long talker. I know him reasonably well from my work at the Smithsonian. He's the chancellor, and I've been the chairman for the last 3 years. And he's not a loquacious person. He's not a person that goes on and on and on. So I think maybe their shorter answers reflect his personality.
And one of the things that I found in that interview that was so interesting is he was a history major at Harvard, but something changed his mind. What happened?
Yes. Well, he wanted to be a historian when he was young. His father said there's no money in that. But John said, I want to be a historian anyway. So John went to Harvard, came back from spring break, gets off at Logan Airport, gets in a cab, says to the cab driver, take me to Harvard. The cab driver said, are you a student at Harvard? Yes, I am. What are you majoring in? I'm majoring in history. The cab driver said, well, when I was a student at Harvard, that's what I majored in also. So all of a sudden it dawned on John Roberts that maybe he'd wind up as a taxi cab driver if he majored in history. And he went to law school.
Certainly a fortuitous cab ride. The one thing that probably stood out to me more than anything in this book is how George Washington, and I never thought about this before, voluntarily gave up power twice as a soldier and as a president. How important is that lesson going forward today?
When George Washington gave up power after he won the Revolutionary War, George III, King of England, said, if it's true that he's giving up power, he's the greatest man on the face of the earth. Why? Because generals who won wars usually became dictators and they stayed in power until they died. George Washington was not that way. He went back to Mount Vernon. And when he was president of the United States, elected unanimously twice, he could have served forever and he could have probably had some relative succeed him, but he didn't want that. So he agreed to serve one term. He ultimately was persuaded to serve a second term. But then when he was done, he moved back to Mount Vernon and he didn't feel anymore that he should have the right to say who the next president should be. So his tradition of serving two terms was ultimately put into law, but it's a good tradition, I think.
All right. He's David Rubenstein. The book is The American Story, Conversations with Master Historians. It's available wherever your fine books are sold. David, this is just a fine, fine addition to our history here of our country, and thank you for putting it out and joining us today.
Thank you very much for giving me this time.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakalskas. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.